Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save It for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
Yeah, see, I think, you know, for me personally, I think when other people think of, you know, California hunting, specifically for waterfowl, your mind goes to the Butte Sink. It's traditional, kind of mystique about it. Trees, big wetlands, typically mallard hunting. What holds that certain mystique, and what makes the Butte Sink so special with the history and still, and it's intact today? I mean, you have the Bean Field, which is, you know, some say the largest concentration of ducks in the U.S. at times, right? Speak to the Butte Sink and how that started, and then kind of where the clubs are at today, because it feels like, you know, we have Gray Lodge and now we have Little Dry Creek, et cetera. But it was kind of always a, not necessarily an off limits place for most people, but, you know, now we own some properties in the Butte Sink, a little bit more public around, and people are going to be able to see really what the hunting has been for a long time.
You know, having hunted in the sink extensively in a variety of clubs, I've hunted almost every club in the sink. Probably 10 I haven't, but and studied the history of it a long time. And let me share these thoughts with you.
Yeah.
First of all, its historical significance is huge. Its uniqueness is huge. It's what we all think about when we think about duck hunting. It's our Arkansas, yeah. One of the most acknowledged places in North America. It truly is a special place. Now, you know, if you are a duck hunter, you don't need to look twice to recognize it as prime waterfowl habitat. Endless acres of marsh and tules, and Butte Creek with its trees, and the buttes themselves, you know, the beacon for migrating waterfowl. It wears its history proudly as one of the most famous waterfowling areas in North America for more than four generations, and hundreds of generations if you consider the original inhabitants. By 1892, there was a new gold rush, but instead of gold, this time it was land, and the best bordered Butte Creek. At this time, duck hunting became the mode of the day, as wealthy men now had leisure time and equipped themselves with the new best weaponry. And, you know, there's a certain moment in a marsh when I invariably think of the Wordsworth poem. Actually, there are two such moments at sunrise and sunset. And it's only a single line from his Tintern Abbey, the one that reads, "Connect the land with the quiet of the sky. At those moments, there is no clear distinction between water and air. The marsh seems to float suspended between identical elements. Up and down are so completely irrelevant that you only know which way is which if your feet are wet and your head isn't." Butte Sink is one of those places where the phenomena is especially strong. If you're a duck hunter, as I mentioned, you don't need to look twice. You'd certainly guess that you weren't the first to tread its meandering channels across expanses of water in pursuit of waterfowl. And this is true, for the Butte Sink wears its history proudly, as I mentioned, is one of the most famous water areas in North America for more than four generations or hundreds, you know, if you talk about the original inhabitants. Now, just by participating, you feel the region's rich history. At heart, I'm a dreamer, and I love to visualize what existed here before the coming of the white man. Historically, Butte Sink consisted of areas of extensive riparian habitat winding through grasslands made fertile by sediment soils laid down over countless centuries. It was a place of rich agricultural potential, but vulnerable to the periodic flooding which swept Sacramento Valley each winter. Before the settlement of the white men there, beginning in the 1800s, the Butte Sink was a wintering paradise for waterfowl, and the supply initially seemed endless. By the 1870s, after most of the large animals had been killed off, market hunters switched to waterfowl, and by the 1880s, market hunting for waterfowl in the Butte Sink had become big business. In his History of the Sacramento Valley, Joseph McGowan wrote, "On one occasion, over 10,000 ducks reached Sacramento in a single day from there. Four companies sold almost 200,000 ducks in San Francisco market in the 1910-11 season, but unofficial estimates place the total number reaching San Francisco that season actually of over 500,000. Now, at the end of the 19th century, the farmlands surrounding the Butte Sink were virtually all leased to market hunters, prompting sportsmen to complain that the commercial guns had all the choice ground. It wasn't long, though, before most of it became the property of gun clubs. It began in November of 1892 when the Colusa Gun Club bought an undivided half interest in 1,388 acres from L.F. Newton, one of the largest ranchers in the area. In the same year, the Gridley Gun Club rented pasture lands to the north, which land that they would later purchase and build a large clubhouse on. And the Gridley Gun Club folded in 1914 and became the holdings of Gray Lodge Gun Club, the Wild Goose Club, and several smaller clubs. Duck hunting had now become the mode of the day for many emerging businessmen and professionals who had the money to purchase a share in a duck club and to equip themselves with the newest weaponry and enjoy leisure time. Now, with the coming of the first railroad and then later the automobile, city sportsmen from San Francisco and Sacramento rapidly displaced the local subsistence hunters and market hunters who had monopolized the inland marshes. Some of the most well-known and respected Butte Sink clubs were formed in 1914, where they celebrated their centennial anniversary. These included the Sacramento Outing Club, the Greenhead Club, the Field and Tule Club, and the North Butte Country Club. Forming soon after were the Berry Patch in 1915, the Wild Goose in 1915 in its present configuration, the West Butte Gun Club in 1916, the Live Oak in 17, the Ellenzar in 20, the White Mallard in 23, Butte Lodge Outing in 26, Sutter Butte Outing in 42. Today, the heart of the Butte Sink boasts some 60 clubs on approximately 18,000 acres. Not including the additional 10,000 acres when figuring in contiguous state and federal refuges. Interesting, some of these clubs were formed earlier, but in different configurations, but different locations and other things. Now, vast environmental changes have occurred in the Butte Sink, and although it will never be able to restore its original condition, significant efforts have been made to preserve and enhance it. Notably, the most important effort was made in 1931 when the California Department of Fish and Game acquired the 2,520-acre Gray Lodge Gun Club and converted it to the Gray Lodge State Wildlife Refuge. Since then, it has grown to 9,240 acres. Fortunately, Gray Lodge was only the beginning. The state has since expanded the refuge system, including the noteworthy Little Dry Creek Wildlife Refuge, starting with the Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge in 1937. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service established six waterfowl sanctuaries in the proximity of the Butte Sink. Among these, the centrally located 400-acre Butte Sink National Wildlife Refuge, known as the Bean Field, serves as a sanctuary to an estimated 1 million birds at times. Equally important has become the extensive restoration and development of the lands held by private waterfowl clubs and California Waterfowl Association. Many have put the lands in federal or state easement programs, thus keeping them wild in perpetuity. History and traditions abound in the Butte Sink. There are many second and third generation owners, and even a few fourth generation. Everything that is being done today will determine how it will look 100 years from now. There will be many challenges to the continuation of the Butte Sink, but its legacy will preserve it for the next generation.
So the actual Gray Lodge Gun Club, mm-hmm. how many acres was it when it first started?
2,250.
And then just the state just kept acquiring all the smaller clubs?
Yeah, they acquired 12 more properties after
12,
that.
Wow.
Yeah, 12 more properties. You know, it was part of the Gridley Gun Club started in 91, as did the Colusa Shooting Club, the first club in the sink that's still present. A phenomenal place right in the southwest section of the sink.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they just to tell you this as an aside, they, interestingly, their original clubhouse was actually on Butte Creek. It was an ark.
Mm. Oh.
And they had it on poles so it would rise and lower as the sink flooded.
Yeah.
You know, all made out of redwood. I've been in a fabulous place. But then I think it's been about maybe 10, 12 years ago now. They built a new clubhouse that's 20 feet up off the ground. And, you know, so they didn't have to keep dealing with that.
Yeah. And most of the ranching back then, was that just cattle grazing on the meadows and things like that?
Yeah, there was a little agriculture, but it was mostly grazing. You know, interestingly, they didn't have a permanent water source for the Butte Sink. On opening day, there were only certain areas that were flooded, and those were low-lying areas that retained water,
mm-hmm.
you know, left over from the floods of Butte Creek. In the winter, and the rest of it was dry, and so they'd have to wait to hunt, unless they tried to hunt geese or something in the dry lands. An amazing thing happened, though, and the end result is the famous 1922 agreement. And the basis of that was that immediately north of the Butte Sink, the new product in California, rice was being grown. There was a major irrigation district immediately north of them. Irrigation district had a problem. Every time they wanted to harvest the rice, you know, they had to get rid of the water. They had to drain the water. But it would flood the areas below them and badly. Sometimes flood home areas, the edge of Colusa, things like that. And so they had to figure out what to do with this water. Well, at the same time, the Butte Sink needed water.
Mm-hmm.
So they got together, did a mutually agreeable contract, whereas the irrigation district guaranteed the Butte Sink they would send the drain water down by a certain time. And the Butte Sink Association guaranteed that they would accept it. You know, now that, as that water comes in, that water and other drain water coming from Orville Dam, the Wild Goose Club is responsible for allocating that upon call by other clubs to them. Anyways, that agreement is what brought water permanently to the marsh. And it was with that, the clubs were able to start growing more trees, getting the tules back, and growing more duck food again. Prior to that time, as you say, it had been grazed off.
Mm-hmm.
The few small creeks that there were, or the lowlands that retain water, was virtually the only water there.
They're basically waiting till winter to happen to
get
their ducks.
They had to
in.
Wait till the rain started, which was usually the end of November.
Yeah.
You know?
And then with the dam coming in, that also restricted the flooding down in the Butte Sink, right? With just the water in general, in terms of like the old duck clubs, like pre dam.
Which dam really,
really, like the Orville Dam and everything.
Yeah. State
like,
water system.
Yeah, they're like very, very high. And then like after the dam, they're a lot lower, like leveled because of the flooding.
So, you know, again, the main water that comes into the sink is that of Oroville itself, mm-hmm. when it's called upon, and the rice drainage water that comes in, it goes through the control of the wild goose. And I think if I'm not mistaken, Craig Griglione is responsible for that now. One of the members.
Yeah, whoever. Yeah, there's a member of the Live Oak. Yeah.
Yeah. The wild goose.
That's what I meant. I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. I don't know who's in charge of it now, but obviously they're caretaker and all that. But so that water goes right in between two of the properties that we own as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and then and not all the clubs in the sink are signatories to the 22 agreement, but they all at the pleasure of the Waterfowl Association receive water. And you know, the level of that water is essential. Originally, it was much lower than it is now. But in the 20s, late teens and early 20s, when they started using the first outboard motors, they had to dig their boat routes deeper. And to get the water to fill up and then in the boat channels and then go into the hunting land, it had to be raised. So that's why the water is deeper in the Butte Sink now than it used to be. It's still, you know, basically knee deep.
Yeah.
You know, but I'll tell you, they all the clubs have their attributes, and some have some deeper water areas, and the diver ducks go in there. Mm-hmm. Field and Tule is pretty famous for that.
Yeah.
You know, other areas much shallower. Attracting teal and so on and so forth. But from one end of the sink to the other, there are phenomenal clubs. And the traditions are very long. We can talk about the traditions a little bit. Mm-hmm. And they hold on to them. They grasp them with iron hands and won't let go of them.
And what's the time frame? So we got the Sassoon Marsh with their duck club starting, and then with the automobile. When was the push where people were starting to make duck clubs in the Butte Sink, erecting lodges, things like that?
Well, the Butte Gridley Club and the Calusa Shooting Club, you're looking at 1891. And so it was shortly after that. Now, four of the very famous clubs that celebrated their centennial about 5 or 6 years ago. Is that right? No, it's been longer than that now. It'd have to be. 1914, so it would have to be 10 years ago now. Sacramento Outing, North Butte, the Wild Goose, but four of them celebrated, their centennials about 10 years ago. And then shortly after that, all the other clubs started filling in. It both from north to south, they all have their benefits and different attributes. The heart of the sink is really on the east side of it, though. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some great clubs on the west side, but really the heart of the sink, you're looking at the east side.
Gotcha. Who were the people that were creating these clubs? Like the Sassoon Marsh we talked about, it was all the people from San Francisco that were coming. Is mm-hmm. it just people from San Francisco going further that had previously hunted in Sassoon, or is it new clientele, so to speak?
Yeah, good question. Initially, it was Sacramento and Yuba City, Marysville. And, you know, there were some interesting politics that developed. I know at the Calusa Shooting Club, they've got a rule that you can't bring guests if they live in the area, you know, in the Calusa, Yuba City area or something. And the reason that came about, I don't think that that's still in existence, but that was part of their original rules. And the reason that came about is...
I think it is.
Is it still there?
I
knew it was.
You can't be from Calusa County.
I knew it was. That was it. And I know it was from years ago when I visited, but I wasn't sure if it was still active, if the politics were still such. But what happened was, you know, local people would feel offended if they hadn't been invited. So the way that they got around... Because a lot of these members were business people, too. Yeah. And they did business with all these folks. So they simply made a rule that if you lived in Calusa County, you couldn't come as a guest. You could become a member,
yeah,
but you couldn't become a guest.
You could become a member, but you couldn't. Oh, my God.
You know, and that's the way they chose to deal with it. And great group of guys, wonderful place, you know, rich history.
Yeah.
I don't know a spot in the sink that isn't a great place. But that's the story of that.
Funny. Is there one place that you think embodies the Butte sink the most in terms of, you know, habitat, club history, lodge? Probably going to be pretty hard to pick one, but what do you think would be yours?
Oh gosh. I mean, I want to be careful not to embarrass or offend anybody that I don't include them in this.
It could be Gray Lodge. But, refuge. Yeah, exactly.
But no, I loved, any hunt that I'm going on in the Butte Sink is a treasured memory. Wonderful people, great memories, wonderful hunting. But the places I seem to be most closely connected to are the Bering Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Sino and his partner, and the folks that lead the hunting program there and everything. They've done an amazing job. It's 2,600 acres, something like that. And they've set it up so the hunting is sequential in the sense that it's natural habitat, it's Milo, it's corn.
Mm-hmm.
And they have several fields of each, and they flood them as one gets eaten out, they flood the next one. And they have such a strong spirit. They're such good people that I take great, great pleasure. That's without question my favorite place anywhere mm-hmm. in California to hunt. It's not easy. You have to be a good hunter. But if you are, you're going to do well, and you're going to come home with a great memory. Another place that I take great pride and just love to hunt is the Wild Goose. You talk about habitat. There is no better mallard habitat in this state. It is absolutely unimaginable. You truly think you're in Arkansas. And the traditions rung long and strong at that club. And as was said in Gone with the Wind, but when Dorothy said, you're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah.
You know, when you go there, you know you're not in Kansas. It is a phenomenal place. You're welcomed. You always have a great hunt and a great memory. It's hard to describe how the mallards work in that club. They put so much time and effort into maintaining that tree habitat. You know, back in the 50s, when sprig were still a king bird in California, they opened that property up. They took a lot of trees out. And when Gary Kahulus came in, their famed refuge manager, or not refuge, but habitat manager,
mm-hmm.
He immediately convinced them that they needed to start replanting trees and so on and so forth, and brought it back to its glory as a mallard hunting club. Another club that was wide open, brought the sprig in, and they're going through some of the same considerations today is down the southwest corner of the Butte Lodge Outing. They opened up because, sprig was king. And so much has changed since then, and slowly but surely they're converting back over to mallard habitat.
Now, what about the bean field? It is a refuge. It happens to be a closed zone. How did the bean field come to be? And why is it called the bean field?
Well, they grew beans.
Is there beans?
There was human beans there. Yeah. No, they grew beans there, obviously, when it was agricultural. But, it's about, I think I said 400 acres earlier, but it's about 730 acres. And it's federal. And they knew that they had to have a spot in the center of the sink where these birds could winter. They could be fed and they could be safe. And even though that's true, it really benefited the clubs because they hunt those birds leaving and coming back every day, especially coming back,
mm-hmm.
In the morning. Very few clubs hunt in the evening or afternoons in the sink. But The best thing, and matter of fact, about 10 years ago, it started getting, 15 years ago, started getting very degraded because the feds didn't have the money to really take care of it. They'd always thought, oh, it'll take care of itself. Well, it doesn't, you know? So what happened was, and this effort was led by Johnny Ribeiro, prime owner at the West Butte Club, an incredible guy. He's in the Hall of Fame here in California. He gathered together a variety of owners from the different clubs around the bean field. And in discussion, they decided to put their money up. And they approached the feds, and the feds said, yes, we'll let you do it under our guidance, but we're going to get this field put back into shape so it can be healthy for the birds that arrive during migration. And that's ongoing today. So that's the efforts of the surrounding clubs led by Johnny to rebuild, refurbish, reclaim that land for the beautiful spot that it was. You know, originally it was part of the West Butte.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, and it's a real long story. It goes on and on and on, but it's surrounded by some of the very best clubs at the south end of the sink down there, and they all profit handsomely from taking care of it.
Yeah. Well, the first time you always hear the bean field, and like first time I saw it, I was expecting like this flooded timber everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's not that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just pretty much, you know, open marshland or whatnot. But
it's smartweed and mostly smartweed.
Yeah, but like I had a picture in my mind like a clay pools reserve, right?
You were I'm assuming it's not just one giant unit, because when I hear bean field, I think one singular open thing.
There's units within it, but it's like a block, right? If you look on it at a map.
You mentioned clay pool. I can show you something. Who's this book going to go to?
Oh, Philip Claypool.
Philip Claypool. And Philip, you're a friend of mine, but I got to tell you, this is a great little story on the side. I'm up spending a week at the Butte Sink with Gary Bechtel. Excuse me, at the Bohemian Club. And we went to a gathering area one evening and, you know, for a nice outside dinner and conversation with great guys and everything. And an entertainer was introduced. And they introduced this guy. His name was Philip Claypool. I went, oh, my God. And so I went up and introduced myself to him after he performed, who's a member there. I said, Philip, is there any chance that you're related to the Arkansas Claypool family? He's, oh, yeah, that's my family, southern accent and everything. And, you know, of course, it's one of the most famous pictures in the world is Claypool Reservoir with this 400,000 mallards getting up at once. Now, that's a story. Would you like to hear that story?
Yes, please.
This is a good one. So anyways, back in the 50s, there was a wonderful television show called Wide World of Sports, and it was run by a guy named Dave Garraway, and he was one of the first guys to travel all over the nation and do live performances. You know, this is the infamy of television, right? And so there was one week in the late winter, early spring, and I think it was 1957, and he had a week open. He didn't know where to take his TV crew and everything. So he heard about this famous place in Arkansas called Claypool Reservoir. Now, there's two kinds of reservoirs in Arkansas. You've got ones that are just flooded annually, green trees, you know, the image of duck hunting to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the permanent reservoirs. This is, for rice water and stuff like that. These trees are all dead. You know, they cannot exist in 20 feet of water, you know? So anyways, he goes down and he takes a look and he can't believe how many birds are there. And he talks to the owner and one of the clay pools. And he goes, you know, what I want to do is I want to be able to show all those birds rising up to the national audience. And I want to do it live. So they're figuring out, how are they going to do this? They got about a week to get ready. So they take a mile of TV cable into there. And this cable is like 7 feet across in these days. And they go up and they build a blind way up on top of a cypress tree. And on the morning of the, you know, this is all planned. You don't get to retake with live TV. So in the morning of the event, they're up there nice and early and they got their cameras up there and this and that and everything else. And so how are they going to get these birds up all at once? Well, they get a lot of the townsfolk to come out with their boats and they're at the far end, hidden way back in the flooded trees, and they start rowing, right? And they're kind of pushing the birds all down into the big open area that's going to be filmed and everything. Slowly but surely, the birds are all pushed down there, and they got 400,000 mallards in this one open area. Somebody throws a stick of dynamite.
Oh, wow.
And man, they all get up at once.
No kidding.
You know? And then they went on later after that happened, and they got it all on film and everything. They had a duck hunt, and it was real good. Matter of fact, I have it all on. If you remind me when we're through, I've got a CD of that. I'll be happy to give you guys one to take back to.
Yeah, I would love
to
that.
CWA.
Well, anyways, never heard that story.
Yeah, but you know,
have the picture.
You know, we talk about legacy, and especially in the Butte Sink.
Yeah.
And let me share this with you. Multi-generational family club members have dedicated themselves to both the tradition and responsibility for a sustained level of conservation in the Butte Sink. One major early effort was the development of a reliable water source, and I told you about that. They went in and got this water, you know, through the 1922 agreement. But, you know, you got to look at the clubhouses to understand the Butte Sink, and you've got to spend some time there. As wonderful as the marsh is and the experience that you have there, it's equally wonderful in the clubhouses. And the Butte Sink clubhouses bring a perspective to the fact that world-class waterfowling comes at a premium today. Clubs in the marsh become a symbol of a refreshing and invigorating opportunity to step back into an earlier, uncomplicated time where a certain grace reenters your life. Here, traditions and club attributes and personalities are immensely valued, respected, and preserved, including spirited conversations, memorable dinners, and hunting customs. Much of the history is recorded in club shooting logs. History and traditions abound in the Butte Sink. There are many second and third generation owners and even a few fourth generation. Importantly, everything that is done today will determine how it will look 100 years from now. Although there will be many challenges, its legacy will preserve it for the next generation and beyond. You hear that most of the memberships are passed from father to son, and that's very true. Most are. But as in many places, you know, a lot of the young men who are trying to raise a family and establish their careers and everything, they just don't have the time. And often when a father passes away, a lot of these memberships are sold now. Mm-hmm. And so there are opportunities for other people to get involved who's never been involved in the sink before. But as you can well imagine, it's quite expensive. And not just to buy into a club, but the clubs in most instances have appreciative annual assessments. One of the clubs that's taken care of by either older members or generational members who haven't inherited their spots is the natural gas that's on the club, which was found decades ago. And that readily pays the assessment for the people who own those shares.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know,
do you see just, I think of, you know, 20 years from now, we've seen hunter numbers pretty much stay steady across the board for the last 20 years. But not all, but I would say on the majority side, a lot of duck club owners might be 60 plus, right? And a lot of people in their family may not hunt. How do you think that that's going to change in the future? With, do you think a younger generation is going to come, potential duck club owners, or, you know, does that tradition get bought up by the other members that are in the same club that don't want as many people out there to increase their hunting success?
That's always a good consideration at a club. You know, that these membership shares are expensive. So, you know, great discussion takes place if clubs want to buy a membership when it comes available. Most clubs in their bylaws have a first right of refusal clause.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't have a family member to pass it on to, or someone come to them who is highly recommended, or one of the fellows has been hunting with for 20 years or something like that, and everybody feels very comfortable and enjoys being with them, they will consider buying that. But, you know, if you've got 25 to 30 members in your club, that's a lot of people to start buying out.
Oh, yeah.
You know? But, yeah, it does take place. You know, I'd be greatly remiss if I didn't take a moment to mention the habitat managers in these clubs and the important role that they play. Now, about, you know, keeping the clubs developed themselves, it goes hand in hand. Many moist soil management practices and techniques were developed in the Butte Sink by dedicated and knowledgeable club habitat managers, as well as forward-thinking club members. Now, a few of the best known and successful habitat managers were Gary Kahulis at the Wild Goose, who happens to be in the Waterfowlers Hall of Fame, an amazing fellow. Leroy Pennington, who had been a habitat manager at both the Sacramento Outing Club and then the Berry Patch at one point. Gary, Leroy was an amazing guy. You know, he's long past now, but just, I mean, you knew you were in the presence of an old-time gentleman. He was a fabulous guy and, you know, grew up on the Sacramento Outing and just had wonderful stories. And then
Pennington Road, I'm assuming?
Yeah, that's, yeah. Live Oak, huh?
Yeah.
But, and then another family that truly deserves to be mentioned is the Gibson family. There are three brothers and they each manage a different club. One at Sacramento Outing, one at the Stack Club, and some of the clubs near there, the Carr Club, C-A-R-R, the Honolulu. There might be another small one in there. And then the Field and Thule. And so they're all managed by this family, and they certainly need to be acknowledged. You know, these gentlemen also served as mentors for members, developing deep trust and respect for the wetland management practices, the importance of ongoing conservation, and especially ethical hunting. In addition, club members and club managers often met with state and federal legislators, waterfowl organizations like CWA, DU, and other wetland and wildlife experts to gain new and evolving information to continually improve their club and other habitats throughout the state and beyond.
Now, and with the Butte Sink, I mean, I just feel like it's so unique that it probably, out of all the places in California, like, you might see multiple helicopters coming in and out of duck clubs. You know what I mean?
I can name them.
You hear the stories.
There's
the
three within walking steps of each other.
Right. So, I mean, like, I haven't seen one flying around the marsh since Ken Hoffman in Sassoon Marsh, but it's just unique in that, right? So it's just a very special place. And if you're able to be a guest on some of these places, you know, I would say you're very fortunate.
Well, in regards to that, the only thing that club members ask, and it's really honored, is fly right into your location don't fly around, disturb other hunters, disturb the birds, and so on and so forth. And those pilots really adhere to that request.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And since we're talking about the Butte Sink, where does the Butte Sink end and the Upper Butte Basin begin?
On the Gridley-Colusa Highway.
That's the defining line.
That's the line, baby.
Yeah, that's it. And, I had the pleasure of hunting Sanborn Slough long before CWA took ownership. And, you know, you talk about a wonderful group of people. And I was really fortunate to be the guest of Dan Soze there a couple of times. And of course, the Butte Island Club. And, and you know, you've got some great properties there. And what a wonderful opportunity. I love the way you folks extend the opportunities, especially the youth, but you extend opportunities for people that, you know, you just don't get to hunt the Duck Club, the Butte Sink, if you're not a guest of one of the exclusive clubs or be lucky enough to be drawn to hunt at one of the great refuges. Best way, I think, I hope you don't mind me giving you this little plug, but
please do,
is put your name in the hat for those hunts that CWA sponsors. You will have the hunt of a lifetime, and you'll do it in the most amazing place in California.
Yeah, no, we think so. I mean, there's no other real program place out there that, you know, opens the doors to the public with some of these properties that are, we operate them like private clubs, or, you know, try to.
Yes, you do. So, yes, you do. And I hear nothing but wonderful things about the way you run your hunts, the locations you run your hunts. You know, you got them down in the Central Valley. You've got them in the Sassoon Marsh. Where else can you go? I'm thinking just like the Sassoon Marsh for a second. Your Demerton
Grizzly Ranch.
Ranch. I mean, where else can you go an hour in any direction? 10 million people live.
Yeah.
And kill a lemon and nice ducks and some geese.
We get a lot of folks, even during the summer when they're dropping their kids off from camp, that are like local. And they're like, I had no idea this was out here.
Yeah.
Like, just the marsh in general.
Yeah. I got a little personal pride with Demerton and Grizzly Island, because when we first went into this wonderful partnership with the Bechtel family through the California
WCB.
Yes, California.
The first group, the CC.
Yes.
That the Bechtels owned.
Yes. The dog training group.
California Retrievers
Training Association. CRTA. Thank you. I'm getting a little fumbly on my memory here. I was chairman when we worked with the Bechtels at that time, and John Carlson, of course. And it was such a pleasure to work with them and Ken Hoffman and the other people that we needed to work with. It went so smoothly and to a mutual benefit, because CRTA now gets the rights to train at any of those properties anytime other than hunting season, of course. And, I mean, the generosity of the Bechtels and the belief that Ken Hoffman had that this was the best hands to put the property into. And so it just worked out beautifully. It was one of those amazing one in a million opportunities. And, we worked hard on it. I want to really congratulate John Carlson primarily for doing that. But I was so pleased to have had a small part of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it created the foundation to where we're at today, with all the properties that we currently own. So, without those first couple.
And the nice foundation, if anybody ever wants to do anything to help CWA, that foundation, it's so important to keep that active, because that's what pays for the maintenance and the longevity of those properties and the opportunity for folks to get in there and have some great waterfowl hunts.
Our hunt program is still accepting applications for pick hunts. Our fall applications will open July 12th. Go to calwaterfowl.org to apply today. We still have a membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. Some of our upcoming events include CWA Bingo and Tunes in Roseville on July 17th, our Chino Banquet July 31st, and our Santa Margarita Banquet on August 2nd. Go to calwaterfowl.org to find more information.
So we'll go north, all the way north to the far end of the state in the Klamath Basin. So you want to give us a little introduction to the Klamath Basin, Yancey?
My pleasure. You know, first I want to start by saying this area, not just the Klamath and the immediate basin itself, but that whole northeast corner of California was the last quote-unquote area of wilderness duck hunting in the state because it was an accessing situation where people had to really drive a long ways to be able to experience it. But with that having been said, you know, originally there were 360,000 acres of wetlands in the Klamath Basin. Nature and water were in perfect harmony, the best in the entire Pacific Flyway. This all began to change, however, as homesteaders began to reclaim their wetlands, irrigation, by about 1865. At this time, the prime source for water in the basin came from Upper Klamath Lake, immediately north of Klamath Falls, or Linkville, as it was known today. You know, there's still the Link River up there.
Yeah.
But it's kind of neat that it was originally called Linkville. The first human inhabitants in the Klamath Basin were the ancestors of today's Modoc tribe. After the Modoc War of 1872, white settlement proceeded, and the natural processes in the Klamath Basin were transformed forever. At this time, Lower Klamath Lake was almost 90,000 acres in size, and steamboats plied its waters. Its northern shore lay in Oregon at Linkville, present-day Klamath Falls, and its southern shore was the start of the lava beds. It is with the arrival of the American pioneers in the mid to late 19th century that the conflict over the purpose of the wild lands in the Klamath Basin became more clear-cut. The agricultural practices of the new settlers, and in particular, their desire to drain wetlands for farming, set the stage for the wholesale changes in the waterfowl habitat. However, it was the immediate threat of market hunting of birds, primarily for their feathers, that triggered the first effort by William Finley of the National Audubon Society to set up a wildlife refuge in the early years of the 20th century. And in 1908, President Theodore Roosevelt established the first national wildlife refuge in the nation for nesting migratory waterfowl in the Lower Klamath Marsh. The impact of this refuge and the conflict over water supply and land use created a deep and lasting schism. The dilemma was that the land was also to be the first wildlife refuge at Lower Klamath, to be a watershed being revamped by Reclamation Service, later to be named the Bureau of Reclamation, and the conflicts would have to be worked out over time. The goal of the Reclamation Service was to drain the marsh and make it available to homesteading and agriculture. However, the president's executive order limited the refuge to public lands unsuitable for agricultural purposes. Soon, the service's botanists discovered that the soils were too alkaline for crops. This should have shut down the idea of draining the marshland once and for all, but it was not to be. Reclaimed plans, however, were postponed. Soon, though, with the advent of the Klamath Project, an ambitious scheme in 1906, involving three lakes, two major rivers, and an interconnecting network of man-made canals, was created. When the project was completed, it was able to be a reliable and controlled source of water to hundreds of farmers in the Klamath and Tule Lake basins, and to reclaim large tracts of land submerged under the Tule and Lower Klamath Lakes. Now, John Wesley Powell, had earlier championed the use of the nation's resources, especially water. He felt all water sources should be impounded and used for irrigation, and individuals be granted grazing parcels to help feed the nation. This was the germ of the 1902 Reclamation Act, which had the most far-reaching and profound effect upon Klamath and Tule basins of any act by funding irrigation projects through the sale of federal lands. In addition, land reclaimed from swamps and lakes under the act was to be opened for homesteading. At this time, Klamath Irrigation District was formed with the explicit purpose of draining the lakes and providing dependable water to ranchers. And adding to the death knell of the Lower Klamath Marsh, in 1909, the Northern Railway Company built a berm across the northern end of the marsh. Initially, the head gates were left open that allowed the surging spring floods of the Klamath River to continue to refresh the marsh. But in 1917, when the head gates below the berm were permanently closed, it resulted in blocking and the in and out flow of the Klamath River water to and from Lower Klamath Lake. This resulted in the lake being dried up for almost 30 years. Change accelerated in the basin. Irrigation projects fostered a boom in agriculture. The offer of free land for homesteading drew new waves of settlers, and the need for commercial centers led to the founding of several towns. In the Oregon side, or Merrill, founded in 1890, and Malin, settled in 1909. The two communities in California side are Tule Lake, opened for settlement in 1931, and Newell, given town site status in 1951. Now, after World War I and again after World War II, the Reclamation Service made available farm units for returning soldiers and their families. Basin farmers and ranchers now saw the refuges as competitors for water, homes for birds that ate their crops. In 1928, the Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge was established by President Calvin Coolidge as a refuge and breeding ground for birds. The Lower Klamath Refuge, dusty and barren through the late 1940s, was a wasteland and a monument symbolic of an actual to heedless greed. But success in settling the different lands of the American West hadn't been managed by people given to quitting. That which had been ruined by developers could be repaired by engineers. Runoff water from the reclaimed Tule Lake farmlands was being pumped into the headwater ditches and reused for irrigation before collecting in the Tule Lake sump, where it was left to evaporate. This was an efficient use of water, but an interrelated set of problems was developing. First, farmers wanted the sump lands for agriculture. Second, as farmers increased their use of water, the sump would overfill. Third, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, previously the U.S. Biological Survey, were protesting that not enough fresh water was flowing into the Tule Lake sump. As a consequence, botulism was taking a heavy toll on migratory waterfowl, threatening the population of the Pacific Flyway, and of course, there was the Klamath Lake disaster. I want to interject something before I go any further. I'm talking a lot about reclaimed land for agriculture and, you know, all the problems that it created and so on and so forth. But I want to be clear. I am very pro-agriculture.
Yeah.
And ag is the friend of wildlife today.
Yeah.
Wildlife depends on it for their food and habitat. So I'm not trying in any way to be rude or unloyal or fib to you or anything else like that.
Yeah, I don't think that's the tone.
It's just that an inordinate amount of wetlands have been drained to support ag. And a lot of that ag feeds our country. But guess what? A lot of it goes out of the country too. Where's most of the alfalfa go today that we don't use? Saudi Arabia. They love to eat steak and they love racehorses. you know, where do a lot of the almonds go? India and China. And that's great for the economy. And I applaud our ranchers and farmers. They do everything in the world on our behalf. But again, I'm just reflecting on the honesty of the amount of wetlands that were, you know, drained and turned into agriculture.
When you talk about the refuge, so there's Tule Lake and then there's Lower Klamath.
Mm-hmm.
Tule Lake came first, Lower Klamath came later, or was that all at the same time?
No, 1908, Lower Klamath Lake.
Okay.
Lower Klamath Lake. By the way, you could not hunt there originally. Couldn't hunt there. I think it was till 52. I'll come to that in a minute. But you were able to hunt right away at Tule Lake in 28. One of the differences was that Klamath did not produce food. Too alkaline, too much peat soil. Tule Lake was prolific immediately. The agriculture was highly successful there. So I'm going to cover a lot of that stuff in this little bit, and then I'll be happy to answer your specific questions. I think it gives a little, some perspective and context to hear the history. So the sump in Tule Lake Basin was overflowing with runoff water, while Lower Klamath, only a few miles away to the west over Sheepy Ridge, which, by the way, I'll get to it in a few minutes. I'm going to tell you about the hunting on Sheepy Ridge.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the spots.
Yeah. So the over Sheepy Ridge was on, Lower Klamath was on fire. You know, the peat soil was on fire. It was raging with dust storms and bone dry. It occurred that these problems could be solved in a single elegant solution, getting rid of the excess drain water, reflooding Lower Klamath Lake. And they did this by constructing a 6,000-foot tunnel under Sheepy Ridge. Excess water from the Tule Lake sump could be pumped up 60 feet and delivered through the tunnel at Lower Klamath Lake. Now, it was not until 1942 that the construction of the Sheepy Ridge Tunnel that linked the Lost River, Tule Lake, and the Klamath River, Lower Klamath Marsh, that the conflict over water was thought to be largely solved. Still, the conflict left its mark, with refuge land set aside for farming, unique among refuges in the U.S., and the water supply of the refuges depended upon the goodwill of the Klamath Irrigation District and the Reclamation District, too. So in post-World War II, the growing role of conservation had significant effect on the scientific manage of the refuge, with scientists serving the role as arbitrators between economic and environmental interests. The Klamath water issue came to a head in the early 2000s when federal agencies implemented single species management initiatives for three fish, the coho salmon, the short-nosed, and the Lost River suckers, under the auspices of the Endangered Species Act. The listing of these three fish and the measures taken by several government agencies to protect them would plunge the basin in one of the most severe crises. And at the same time, the Klamath Basin experienced severe drought conditions in which, for the first time, farmers were denied irrigation water. And to make the situation even worse, some 50,000 Klamath River salmon died. The resulting effects tore the communities apart and created bitter distrust. The ensuing struggle over who should receive water would pit basin farmers against the tribes, environmentalists, wildlife preservationists, Pacific Coast fishermen, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, and even the Bureau of Reclamation. Now, a new biological opinion in 2019 made the situation even worse, as it mandated additional water for fish, and due to periods of restricted water delivery, it left the refuge high and dry during critical spring northern migration staging, spring and summer breeding, and summer molting seasons. And if that wasn't challenging enough, the reality in 2022 was that the water crisis was far from over as we continued with yet another severe drought. This one actually was even more serious than the one in 01. In the summer of 2020, some 60,000 waterfowl and shorebirds died tragically. Deaths of the basin refuge due to botulism. All signs pointed to a severely worsening conditions in future summers due to this climate change. The primary issues today rests in the hands of renewed Klamath Restoration Agreement. The original agreement, including assurances of the removal of four California dams on the Upper Klamath River, was ready for acceptance in 2015, when at the last moment legislators withdrew their support. Now that the four dams have been removed, it may again bring together interest of all the essential groups and entities, including the tribes, the Modoc and Klamath, and downstream the Karuk and Yurok, combined with the farmers, environmentalists, and government agencies. Now, for the first time, guaranteed water for the refuges is actually legislated, if water is available. Importantly, a new biological opinion is being formed at this time and will drive the basin water policies for at least the next 5 years. In 1912, the chief of the Biological Survey described the Lower Klamath Refuge as one of the greatest breeding places for waterfowl in the West. Then in 1946 report, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said, "The Klamath Basin carried the greatest concentration of waterfowl in North America, probably the world." With this in mind, the watershed could be reconstructed for human use without killing off the natural life that had lived there for millennia. A reasonable and equitable sharing of water could make this happen. This was the clear message then as it is now.
So why is the Klamath Basin able to hold so many wintering and non-wintering waterfowl?
Well, I'll tell you, basically it holds it up to about the first of December. It freezes then. And so most birds have left by then. I once asked the chief warden in the area, Freitas, what's your favorite time to hunt up here? And he said, when all the hunters leave. I said, but isn't that when, it freezes over? He says, right. He says, but I know all the open water. and I always laugh about that. You know, he's a great guy. He's no longer the warden there. But, of course, his dad is the famous Pookie Freitas, one of the greatest decoy carvers of all time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In Rio Vista.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Your question again was, why do they leave? Well,
how can that area hold so many birds? Like, why is that such an impactful place?
Well, it's, first of all, it's in their DNA crossover. They've been crossing for 10,000 years or longer in that one location, and it's imprinted in their DNA. They know that this is where there's water, quote unquote, where there's food and basic security. It was large enough that even when the market hunters were there, they didn't impact it much, you know? And the natural foods were prolific. But now it's the grains. The grains are a big deal. And the birds love it. For example, when Thule first opened, the thing that was different about hunting at Thule and Lower Klamath, you took a boat to get to where you were going to hunt, either your own small boat that you'd had towed up there, or you went on one of the amazing paddle wheel boats and steamboats that operated there. There were seven different landings, and wherever the best duck hunting was taking place, guys would ride the boat, get off in that spot, hunt for a day, 2 days, get back on and leave and go back home. But basically, you had to use a boat to get to where you were going to get out and hunt on Lower Klamath. Thule Lake, you hunted out of a boat. Prolific Thule patches, deeper water. You had to have a boat. You know, if you had access to private land or something, you could hunt on the edge of that. But when you hunted, the people equally hunted in dry grain fields. It was phenomenal. You know, you had your choice, boat, water, grains. Another thing that makes Tule Lake unique today, but when Lower Klamath, when the Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge opened, it was the same. Both of these places grew crops for different reasons, though. Sacramento Refuge grew crops to keep the birds there and not getting into the farmers' fields. In Lower Klamath, they opened up a certain amount of the land that had been drained for farmers to come in and farm. You know, the farmers wanted to use this incredibly fertile soil, but it was owned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. How could they get in there? They could go in there, they could grow their grains, but they had to leave a quarter of it standing. So it was a partnership. The difference today, the last couple of years, hadn't been any grain growing in there. There's been a lot of, been a lot of row crops and things of that nature. So I don't know how that was affected. You know, I trust that it's going to evolve over time back to grains. Maybe it's crop rotations they needed to do that for the land. I hope it wasn't just due to marketing, you know, because the purpose of growing in there was twofold. Great land for the farmers to farm, but also food for the birds to eat.
Yeah.
And it kept the birds out of the other field.
Right. And you mentioned early on that the head gates were closed so that water wasn't coming down. Yeah. Was that just because the demand for water was so high that they just restricted the flow?
No, they wanted to shut off.
They wanted it.
Because they wanted to get that land. They didn't know at that point how alkaline it was, and it was all peat soil and everything. They wanted to get farming in there. They wanted to get homesteading. And so they shut it off. So essentially, the Bureau of Reclamation got it done for free. You know, when the railroads built the berm across there. Have you driven up to Klamath Falls?
I've been there multiple when you times.
Cross
yeah.
When you cross the California border into Oregon, everything on the both sides, it's called the Klamath Straits. One side is all private property, farmed. You can't drive past any time of the year without seeing specks out there, you know, and ducks and everything else. But the other side, the west side, the Klamath River is over on that side too, but some great, great duck clubs over there. One of them is the Rat Farm, pretty darn large. It's being all rebuilt at this time, burnt out and rebuilt because it had become solid tules. It's a couple of thousand acres. It's pretty big. May as be as big as 3,000. I don't remember exactly. Then there are some private duck clubs on the other side of the river there that do pretty darn well too.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, you were discussing, you know, Tule Lake, and I know you're going to get to this. This is going to be a little bit of a lead-in, but it's hunting in grain. There's hunting over water, and there's hunting over rocks on a ridge. And I had an experience with this. I wasn't duck hunting. I was had an X1 deer tag, and me and my dad were back behind the refuge on the BLM land. Uh-huh. And it was opening day of duck season. And as the sun came up, all you hear is, like, what the heck? And the ducks were flying. The contour of basically Sheepy Ridge up and over. You could only imagine when it was full time and those Indians were up on the tops shooting those ducks.
They were shooting them with bow and arrow. And then hunters years later were shooting them with shotguns. And there's still a couple of the old stone blinds up there. Now, you access that. That's another part of we want to talk about is some of the historical clubs in the area. But one of the real famous ones are right below it. On the shore, almost on the shores of Tule Lake, the base of Sheepy Ridge, that's the Wainema Club. Matter of fact, I had spent some time there probably 20 years, 30 years ago. CWA used to rent it, and we'd have, you know, weekend meetings up there and then go out and ride around in some of the boats on the lake and everything and get to know the area off season.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so you enter it from the Wainema Lodge there, and steep climb, you get up there. And yes, you're right. Originally, and they shot primarily geese, some canvasbacks and geese coming that would just barely crest that ridge. Mm-hmm. And then it was hunted for about 20, 25 years or maybe 40 years. And I don't believe there's any hunting that takes place up there anymore, but great, great history. Great history. And what a view from up there. You see both. You can see, you turn around one way and you see Lower Klamath Lake, and you walk 100 yards over and you see Tule Lake. Pretty darn cool. And you're up high.
Yeah.
You know, and it's pretty, you can just see everywhere and you get a real sense of the geographic history of the area.
Yeah. And, well, I think it's cool. I mean, if you stay at Wainimi, you could just start walking the hill, but like there's all the old like rock little blinds and stuff.
It?
Yeah. You know, it's pretty wild.
It's pretty a neat place and very close to the refuge headquarters and
yeah,
so much cultural history, just like the Indians, and I've found arrowheads up there, Captain Jack Stronghold. Yeah, it's
all the
great area without even waterfowl. It's still an amazing area.
Yeah. Well, my dad told stories of going up there as a kid and like sleeping in a little potato shack or something like that. Yeah, and there was like a stove in it, and then they would go back to San Jose and. You know, that's what they did for 3-4 days.
There really weren't a lot of clubs up there.
Yeah.
What there really was private land.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those landowners would lease out the rights to hunt to groups of guys. And they'd call it their club, but it, you know,
yeah,
wasn't for the public. And then there were, over time, there were some, on Upper Klamath Lake in Oregon, there were a couple of big sort of arcs that were used as duck club houses. But primarily, again, those were day shoots or week-long shoots and things. That just doesn't have a real long tradition of clubs, but it does have a real tradition of private land club shooting, you know.
You mentioned something about the town, Tule Lake, in like the 1930s is kind of when it was started. But I would say now until when I was there, you know, 20 years ago, at one point, it was like a big booming town with, you know, bowling alleys and theaters and all that. And now, you know, there's not a whole lot left.
No, it's, going you're not sure if it's open or not when you drive through anymore.
Yeah.
Sadly.
It's sad. But I mean, even when I was up there, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there was like a bar, there was the grocery store, gas station, and everything else pretty much boarded up, right? Yeah. You know, it was sad. But you could just see back in the heyday, like, that one time was a bustling little town. You know, the store that made all the down pillows and all that, you'd take your ducks there.
Yeah, I've been there.
You know, so everyone,
when it was still
open. Yeah, but everyone went there, right? After a good day's hunt, everyone went there, got their birds cleaned, and then it'd head home.
Matter of fact, there's a gal that ran that, that operation, and she's in the California Hall of Fame.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah, Trudy.
Yeah.
Trudy, right. I hadn't thought about that for years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was quite a gal.
Well, I just always thought, like, you know, if you could picture one place that you could hunt that's probably more like Canada more than any other place that's public, Klamath, right? You could go hunt out of a boat. You could go hunt out of a grain field. You could walk into units. You could scout. You could hunt 7 days a week. It's just so unique and vast. And if you've never experienced it, it's one of those special places. Just the history of it, the surroundings, the views. To me, it's always a special place to have hunted.
Well, you know, the three of us talked at lunchtime about some commonly known areas up there and people, and we talked about the Great Marsh Island Ranch that Tupper Blake owned, developed and owned. And sadly, you know, he passed about a year and a half ago, and he was a dear friend, and I hunted with him up there, and he's in the, acknowledged all over North America, for his fine work with photography. You know, he showed it in every major museum in North America, including Canada and Mexico. But Tupper was a dear friend and, built his home and his guest house and few other abodes on top of a 200-foot lava dome in an area that originally been part of Lower Klamath Marsh, but had been drained and turned. It really became a degraded cattle ranch, you know. And Tupper saw, he learned historically about what it used to be, and his good creative mind, he was able to determine what it could be again. It's a great story about how he built his house and everything, but let me tell you, he bought this property and brought it back to fruition, and it became one of the most phenomenal mallard hunting spots I've ever been in my life. He treated it with so much respect. You know, he really did a wonderful job there. Real quickly, he'd been looking for, he wanted to build a log cabin on the top of this 200-foot cliff. By the way, you're up there, you're above the birds coming in. And that was a beautiful thing. I can't tell you the number of late afternoons we're sitting on the deck having a nice libation and see the ducks coming in, and all of a sudden they're below you flying, you know, and it was just so heartwarming and wonderful to see. But, you know, he bought this lava dome right in the center, bought the property. It was all degated. He started getting it rejuvenated, but he wanted to build this beautiful log cabin. So he looked all over for years, couldn't find the log. Finally, driving up in the highest, the furthest north of all the six sections of the Federal Wildlife Refuge up there, and went into the Klamath Basin up there, far to the north, and driving along, and he sees this guy, and he sees these old log cabins and everything, and he asks the guy, he goes, you know, I'm looking for logs everywhere. I want to build a log cabin, a lodge on my property. And he says, do you know who owns all those cabins over there and everything? You know, just falling apart kind of places. And this guy says, well, I'm going to be the future refuge manager here, federal refuge manager, and we have a mandate to get all man-made things off here. And if you can get those logs out of here within a week, you can have them. So Tupper rushes back to Klamath Falls, hires a logging truck and a boom truck and everything he needs, drives up there, gets every one of those logs torn apart, loaded on the log truck, you know, labeled where they go, numbered logs, gets them back to his place while he's still working as a renowned wildlife photographer, spends 10 years himself refurbishing those logs, and then has the most beautiful personal lodge built on the top of that 200-foot lava dome, you know, with a walk-around deck all the way around, separate sleeping quarters, separate guest quarters, separate office. I might mention, put a little plug in, that's going to be for sale on July 1st. And if anybody has any interest in learning about it, you know, I'll put you in touch. If you want to contact me, I'll put you in touch with the family, and you can have a discussion with them.
Carson, grab the number. They'll take a cash offer. You just offer them what you can. Yeah,
they'll take it out of my next paycheck.
I'll be designated shooter.
Yeah, but take it out of my next paycheck.
I know that there's some interest in it already, and it's a dream spot. You know, I never hunted there once in 20 years that I didn't get my limit of mallards.
Special spot.
Special fella. You know, world-class guy. Dear, dear friend who took good care of his marsh. And it's going to be available to the public.
Now, what do you think the next 100 years looks like for the Klamath base, then Lower Klamath, Tule? How do you see that changing?
Well, it's all water related, of course. And for the first time, the refuge has some legal access to water, refuges. But both of those refuges, I mean, the water has to be there to access it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's pretty stiff competition for water in that basin. Primarily, it comes out of Upper Klamath Lake. But of course, the Wood River right above it has nine incredible streams. I mean, they're like spring creeks almost, you know, these, just the fishing is indescribable, but it's all private and so on. But that flows through the Wood River Valley and then into Upper Klamath Lake. And then the biological opinion is such that the water has to be at a certain level to preserve the two types of suckers fish that live in that lake, which are very, very important to the tribes, especially the Klamath River, Klamath tribe. They're ceremonially, I can hardly say that. They're very important for ceremonies, and they provide wonderful nutrition. But because of the severe droughts we've been having, their spawning streams above the lake are not able to sustain, you know, production of these fish. So they tend to get to a certain size in the lake, and then they just can't make it. And so a bunch of things are being done. First of all, they're really trying to eliminate the nutrients that go into the lake from the ranching, the farming, so on and so forth. And, you know, everything is keyed in on them. But these are very, very important. They're so ceremonially important to the tribes. So one of the most important things that we've got to do is we've got to get that healthy again. And they're working towards it now, eliminating as much phosphorus and other types of nutrients going into that lake possible. But there are certain places that are raising these different types of suckers. Carl Winter, an amazing person who lives at the south end of the lake and is ranching and farming 400 acres at the south end, has the most amazing natural springs flowing up into the middle of his ranch, and he's helping to successfully raise suckers there. Problem is they get to a certain size and they just can't live under the conditions anymore. But that's one of the biggest problems that's being solved up right now. And you can't lower the lake for agriculture or for the refuges along a certain point, because it'll add to the demise of these suckers, you know? And so there's that middle ground where you try to work to support agriculture and wildlife needs and what's so very important to the tribes up there. So Carl has been intimately involved in that, doing a great job. And also, I might add, doing a great deal, been a real advocate and spokesperson for CWA up there. You know, of course, CWA, and I'm part of that team that's been working up there. One of the amazing things we did trying to get more water to be dedicated in perpetuity to the refuges, Lower Klamath Refuge, is where we searched and found some water rights that were available above the lake. And we worked with a family for a couple of years and finally put it all together. And between the fundraising that we did and the money we got from the federal government, it was enough to buy the water rights from that family. So that now is going into Unit 2, is going to Lower Klamath Lake and helping with that situation. Unit 2, right next to Tupper Blake's Marsh Island Ranch, by the way, is the most important spot in Lower Klamath Lake. That's where the breeding takes place. That's where the molting takes place. That's where, you know, I could go on and on and on and on. And so that, all that water comes from Wood River Valley, Upper Klamath Lake, but only when the lake is high enough so it can sustain the suckerfish that live in there in good living conditions still.
And can you speak to the importance of the relationship between like the Sassoon Marsh and the Klamath Basin for the ducks that we breed in California in terms of the habitat that those areas provide and how our local ducks really thrive in those specific
two
places?
Like we shoot so many local mallards. We don't shoot a lot of migratory mallards in California, and a lot of them come from either Klamath or the Sassoon Marsh. Yeah.
Well, it's my understanding, and you know, you're working with the best biological organization, hunter's rights organization in the state, no question. And we have some good ones, but it's my understanding that Upper Klamath plays an important role. It is the major staging area for birds, in particular mallards, going both north and south. The other thing is, it's an area that plays significant role as breeding grounds, okay? And uniquely, a lot of our California mallards go back up there to molt, you know, and they're defenseless when they're there. The problem emanates from low, warm water. You know, the botulism disease is always in the ground. It's just that it becomes active when the water is low and too warm. But it's just the most important spot, you know, Klamath, in the whole Pacific Flyway. Again, both going south and north. The thing that makes Sassoon so important, well, it has this historical significance too. You know, it fed San Francisco, you know, during the gold rush, helped feed San Francisco during the gold rush. But it's a natural place for the birds to go in winter. The only reason they're not wintering in Sassoon to the extent that they used to is that we just can't produce the food there that we used to produce. You know, there's so much salt intrusion. By the way, you're probably aware of it, you know, the activity that's taking place to turn 10,000 acres of that 89,000 acres, over 52,000 actually, wetlands, to turn it back into tidal, 10,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
It's all being done voluntarily. You know, nobody's being forced into it. But it's a real statement on the fact that we got to do something with that salt-laden water that's coming in. That's one of the things that's being done to respond to it.
Yep.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.